I must confess I've been struggling with this particular talk, and the reason is twofold. The first one is, in order to give a talk on this text, I need to understand it. And it's a perfection of wisdom text. And if I really understood it, I'd be a Buddha. And I can assure you I'm not a Buddha. So really trying to, the past few weeks, I haven't really been writing talks. I've been studying the text and trying to really get what it's trying to say, which has not been an easy thing to do. That's the first problem I encountered. The second problem was, once I understood it at least to a little bit, I had to try to make it accessible, because I didn't know who was going to be on this retreat, and I was going to be a bunch of men, but I didn't know whether you would know a lot about the Dharma, whether you didn't know anything. So trying to make this very subtle, rather difficult text accessible has been quite a big challenge. Some of you know that after the Buddha's enlightenment, he wondered whether he could teach what he'd experienced. And he said something like, this Dharma, which is profound or deep, gambhira, deep, subtle, to be understood only by the wise. And at first he thought, no, I won't be able to teach this. But then he changed his mind a bit later, thankfully. But this text is all about gambhira, deep, subtle, to be understood by the wise. So, I've done my best, and of course my inspiration has been Bhante Sangharakshita, who gave this brilliant series of lectures on the Vimalakirti Nidesha, which is a similar kind of text, in a way, and he managed to make it very accessible to his audiences, which were the general public. So, anyway, this is my attempt to do a similar kind of thing. And yesterday we looked at, I think, five verses altogether. The first verse in a lot of detail, and then the next four verses, wasn't it? And then the next three verses in less detail. In this talk, I'm probably only going to talk about one or two verses. And obviously I'm not going to be able to do a talk about all the verses in the time we've got, as I said yesterday, I think. But what I'm going to try to do today is give you a key to understand the rest of the whole of the text. So hopefully by the end of this talk you'll be able to read the rest of the text and make more sense of it than you did before I gave the talk. That's my wish. Shraddhapa has already done some of that work. He gave us a very important key yesterday, and I'm going to try and give you another key. So hopefully it will help you understand the text. Before I talk about verse 5, though, I just need to give you a bit of background, because the text hasn't come out of nowhere. It's come out of a context. And the context is probably about 500 years after the Buddha, 400 or 500 years after the Buddha. The Buddha's been dead. He attained parinirvana 400 or 500 years previously. And what happened after the time of the Buddha is different people had different understandings of what the Buddha said. And you get at least 18 Buddhist schools about 100 years after the Buddha's death. All disagreeing on various elements of the Dharma. So, we don't know exactly when this happened, but 300, 400, 500 years after the Buddha, this new way of understanding the Dharma came about, called the Mahayana, the great way or the great vehicle. And I'm just going to say a little bit about that, because this is a Mahayana text. So just to give you a bit of an understanding of what that means. In early Buddhism, you get the Buddha, a man, a human being, who gained awakening, who gained enlightenment, who woke up. And he then taught, and he had disciples, shravakas, listeners. They listened to him. because it was an all society, they listened to him and they put into practice what he taught, and some of them gained awakening just like the Buddha, although they didn't call themselves Buddhas, that was reserved for the Buddha. They called themselves Arahants, but their awakening was the same as the Buddha's. Very simple. It's a lovely, simple kind of scenario, really. But then, a little while later, the way the Mahayana arose was, it seems that some people weren't content just to become Arahants after the Buddha. They wanted to become Buddhas themselves, which means they wanted to practice what the Buddha taught, but die and then get reborn and practice over and over and over again, just like the Buddha apparently did in the myth of the Buddha. He practiced for innumerous lifetimes, many, many thousands, millions of years of practice, until he perfected both his wisdom and his merit, so that he was really, really attractive person. And then he, as it were, rediscovered the Dharma in a place where there was no Dharma. So this is the myth of the Buddha. So he wasn't just a human being who happened to gain enlightenment in this lifetime. There was a whole, you know, backstory to it. So what the Mahayana, what they were interested in is not just becoming awakened through the Buddha's teaching and then dying. What they were interested in is emulating the Buddha and putting off their enlightenment, as it were, and rediscovering the Dharma in a place, in a land, in a world system where there is no Buddha, and they bring the Dharma to the beings of that land. So that's the backstory. And someone who's just training to become an Arahant, I just said just, didn't I? Just training to become an Arahant. If that's quite an easy thing to do. No, it's not an easy thing to do. Someone who's training to become an Arahant is called a Shravaka, a listener, a disciple. And someone who's training to become a full Buddha is called a Bodhisattva. Bodhi, Buddha. Sattva, being. Someone who's trying to become just like the Buddha. And what happens is the Bodhicitta arises within them. Chitta, you heard yesterday, chitta is mind or heart. So the Bodhi mind or the Bodhi heart arises within them, and they have this tremendous intention to do exactly what the Buddha did. So there's the backstory to the Mahayana. Very, very simplified and probably oversimplified, but I don't want to talk too much about that because I've got this text to talk about. But I think that's enough information for you. So, I forgot to bring the text with me from my bedroom, so I've got Shraddhapa's copy here. Were you going to write on it and take notes? No. Okay. Just as well, because you can't have it. So, verse 5. We heard verse 5 already, so let's hear it again. In this practice, no highest perfection of wisdom is obtained. No state of bodhisattvahood is obtained, nor any awakening mind. A bodhisattva who can hear this without becoming confused or afraid is practicing the wisdom of the Sugatas. So, Sugata. Sugata is another title for the Buddha. Now, we've had a number of titles for the Buddha in this text. We've heard he's the bull among human beings, the gentle one, and a few others. And here we have the Sugata. And in the very earliest texts, like the Sutta Nipata, for instance, take the fifth chapter of the Sutta Nipata, the Parayana, the way to the beyond, you get these 16 Brahmins all asking questions of the Buddha, and they call him all sorts of things, good things. They don't just call, I'm not sure they even call him the Buddha in that text, so they call him all sorts of lovely things. And in the early days of Buddhism, they hadn't settled on a title for the Buddha. And one of the titles they gave him was Sugata. Gata meaning to go, and Su, which is happy. So often Sugata is translated as the happy one. And it's interesting that we are a Buddhist movement. We could have been a Sugatist movement, or any other of the titles. We could have been the happy ones. the Sugatists. But here he's, this is another title for the Buddha. That's a bit by the by, of course, but so now you know that when it says no state of bodhisattvahood is obtained, you know what the text is referring to. It's this, referring to this state of the bodhisattva, and how does the bodhisattva become a bodhisattva? With the arising of the bodhicitta, which is the next clause, nor any awakening mind. This is Shraddhapa's translation of the bodhicitta, the awakening mind. So, in this practice, the Mahayana practice, no highest perfection of wisdom is obtained. Yet, in verse 6, the last line, and they attain the awakening of the Sugatas. So that seems a bit contradictory, doesn't it? Notwithstanding what Shraddhapa was saying yesterday, here in verse 5 it says, no highest perfection of wisdom have attained, yet in verse 6 they attain the awakening of the Sugatas, which is the highest perfection of wisdom. And a bit later on, the last line of verse 8, a bodhisattva like this is close to awakening. Verse 10, they attain the firmness of wisdom. So that does seem very contradictory and paradoxical. So let's just go into this. Well, Shraddhapa's already spoken about this to some extent, but I just want to really go into this today. Because it's not only important to understand the text, I think it's important for our spiritual lives. It's important the way we approach and conceive of our spiritual lives. No highest perfection of wisdom is obtained. So what does obtain mean? I looked it up in the dictionary, and it means to get through effort, to gain. So that's important. No highest perfection of wisdom is got, is gained. You can't get it. It's interesting, a bit later on, like in verse 12, this is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. And verse 14 is this the same. And this is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. You cannot get wisdom. And this is similar in the Heart Sutra, isn't it? As we recited last night. Not even wisdom to attain. Attain means more or less the same as obtain. I looked that up too, and it means to gain through effort, to get through effort. So not even the highest perfection of wisdom can be obtained. No wisdom, not even wisdom, is attained. So what are we doing then? What are we doing? This text is all about perfection of wisdom. It's a perfection of wisdom text. It's showing us how to become wise, how to, in a way, get wisdom. And it's saying, you can't get it. You can't have it. You can't have wisdom. No state of bodhisattvahood is obtained. This is a Mahayana text. It's all about the bodhisattva, the bodhisattva's practice and wisdom. But there's no state of bodhisattvahood to be obtained, nor any bodhicitta. No, the arising of the bodhicitta. No bodhicitta. A bodhisattva, now this is interesting, he's just said no state of bodhisattvahood is obtained, yet in the next line it says, a bodhisattva who can hear this without becoming confused or afraid is practicing the wisdom of the Sugatas. Well, it is confusing, isn't it? So good on the bodhisattva who can understand this without becoming confused and afraid. Hopefully by the end of this talk, we won't be confused and afraid. Although if we are confused and afraid, maybe that's a good thing. Because after all, probably not many people here are bodhisattvas. So maybe being confused and afraid is a good thing. stage to go through. It's just like, when I'm teaching, when I'm leading a study group, one of my aims is to guide people into a state of what I call positive bewilderment. Positive bewilderment is really, really good place to be, because it's not the same as being confused. I distinguish between positive bewilderment and confusion, because confusion gets you nowhere, but positive bewilderment means you realise now you don't really know anything. Everything you thought you know was just provisional. You stood on it. It was like a stepping stone, but it wasn't real wisdom. And often in the study group, if you've been in study groups, you'll have got a bit frustrated sometimes, because, especially if you're leading a study group, because people aren't really learning. They're just swapping information. Oh yeah, and there's this, and sometimes they're showing off information, they're showing off what they know, and no one's really listening. But what I try to do is I try to bring people into a state in which they drop what they already know. They let that go, and they realise that they don't really know what they're talking about. This happens when somebody's maybe talks about integration. You know, integration is one of the buzzwords. It's one of the jargonese that we use, integration. And then I say, just say what you mean by integration. And it's amazing what happens. It's like, integration. No, I don't really know what you mean by it. Can you say more? And they don't actually know what they're talking about. And we do this a lot, because we've got all these words that we've got used to. They're like the furniture of our minds, and we just ban them around as if we know what we're talking about. And perhaps we did once when we told what integration really means, we got it, and then we lost it. But we keep using the word. So one of the things I do in study groups is try to get people to a stage where they actually don't really know what they're talking about, and they get a bit bewildered. And it's unpleasant for them, because it gives people security to stand on the knowledge that they already have. So what I do is I just try to get people into this stage where they realise they don't really know. And when they admit that, it's tremendous, because now they'll really begin to start learning. And it's the same for me as a study group leader. It's not as if I'm doing this to people, sort of forcing them into this unpleasant state so they'll learn. It's the same for me. I love it when that happens. When somebody says, I say something off patch, you know, something about the Bodhisattva, and they say, what does that actually mean? Actually, I don't really know. Let's explore this together. What does that mean? And that's wonderful, because then people are really learning. So the stage of bewilderment, positive confusion, you could say, or I prefer positive bewilderment, is a really good place to be. And of course, those of you who've been around for a long time, you know a lot. And that is, you know a lot of the lists and the definitions. And then it's very easy to think that because you know all this stuff, you actually understand the Dharma. But those two are very different things, as Sridharpa was saying yesterday. Now, I didn't mean to say any of that. That was all just came to me. So I've got to get back to the text now. In this practice, no highest perfection of wisdom is obtained. No state of bodhisattvahood is obtained, nor any awakening mind. Now, why is the Buddha saying that? Because when you go back to early Buddhism, the early text, the Pali text, there is a state of wisdom to be obtained. There is a goal. There's a state of enlightenment to which people are aspiring and trying to reach. And the Buddha is trying to help them reach that. And there's a path. Interesting, there's no path mentioned in this text. But in the early Pali text, Magga is the path to awakening. And there's a path to be trod. And it's really quite simple. So suddenly the text is saying, no, there isn't a stage of wisdom to be obtained. And there's no bodhisattvahood to be obtained. And not even any bodhicitta to arise. So what's going on? Why is the text trying to confuse its listeners in this way? Why is it making us a bit afraid? We don't really know what the Dharma is anymore. We don't know everything we stood on has been taken away. It's been taken from under our feet. So what's going on? There's a very interesting lecture by Bhante called What is Nirvana? And in that, he talks for quite a while, actually, about what he calls the psychology of goal setting. Don't know if you know that passage. It's in What is the Dharma? And it's also in the Essential Sangharakṣita, which makes me think it must be important. It's sort of in a number of places. It's very interesting. So just to summarise a rather long discussion, what happens is everyone wants to be happy, and everyone has the goal of trying to become happy. And that's what the Dharma's all about, isn't it? The Dharma's the real way to become happy, and awakening is the sukhita, it's the really happy state. So you come to a Buddhist centre, and you hear that the goal is awakening. And it's not any ordinary kind of happiness, it's a very special kind of happiness. It's a happiness that you can't lose once you've got it. So you think, oh, that's the one I want. So then you set that as your goal. But what happens, the psychology of goal setting, is as soon as you set a goal, you kind of overlook where you're at. You've now got this goal of happiness because you're fairly unhappy, so you want to become happy. And the psychology of goal setting means that now you're reaching for something which actually you know nothing about. You don't really know what enlightenment is. You've got these words, freedom, compassion, etc., wisdom, but you don't really know what that all means. But still, you're striving towards it. And what you're doing is you're, in a way, denying your actual state where you are. So rather than work at the causes of your unhappiness, you try to leapfrog into this state of happiness, pure happiness. And it doesn't work. And it's partly to do with language, because we have to use metaphors to talk about our inner life. There's no other way to talk about our inner life apart from metaphors. So the main metaphor in early Buddhism is path and goal. So you've got the path leading to the goal. And of course that's an external thing. It happens, you know, you might be going to Manchester and there's a road or a train leading to Manchester, and you get to Manchester, and that all happens in the world. But we kind of take that model, that metaphor, and we put it inside ourselves, and we think that's what the spiritual life is all about. There's a path leading to wisdom. But it's not really like that. So there's another book by Larry Rosenberg called Breath by Breath, and it's all about the mindfulness of breathing. And there's a really lovely little teaching in there called The Paradox of Meditation. And the paradox of meditation is that you are where you're at, wherever that is, and you want to get somewhere else. You want to get concentrated, absorbed, happy, etc., etc. So now you set up this goal in meditation. That's what you're trying to do. Let's call where you're at A, and the goal you're trying to achieve B. Yeah, so there's A and there's B, and you're at A and you want to get to B. So the question arises, how do you get from A to B? This is a big question, isn't it? Because it's not just the paradox of meditation, it's actually the paradox of the spiritual life. It's the paradox of the inner life. How do you get from A to B? Well, the paradox is, to get from A to B, you really have to be at A. That's really perfection of wisdom-ish, isn't it? To get from A to B, you really have to be at A. Now, what does that mean? It means that rather than striving to get somewhere else, rather than trying to be a different person than the one you are, rather than trying to get from the mental state you're in to another mental state, which is really what we're trying to do in the spiritual life, rather than trying to do that, what you really have to do is be where you are and really investigate, not in a mental way, but be curious about your actual experience. So let's say you're quite distracted and you want to become concentrated. Explore distraction. You can't just suddenly become concentrated from a distracted state. So you're distracted. So explore that state. What does distraction feel like? What is it like to be distracted? Imagine that you're a novelist and you have to really describe in this novel someone who's terribly distracted, and you have to describe it so that people really get what that person's state of mind is. Imagine you're doing that, but you're doing it for yourself. What is this state of distraction or unhappiness? Oh, I want to be happy, but I'm unhappy. Well, what does unhappy mean? What does that word actually mean? It means so many things. What is your state of unhappiness like? What's it really like to be unhappy? How does it feel? Describe it to yourself. But not only describe it, but feel it as fully as you can. Go to the root of the unhappiness. I think that's something about what the perfection of wisdom is saying. You've set up this goal of enlightenment, or the Buddha did, and now we're all trying to get to enlightenment, but how do we do that? And what we try to do is go there, but that doesn't work. And I can tell you that from my own experience. As you've heard, I've been around Sri Ratna for 44 years, and 20 years ago, I had this massive crisis. Sorry if you've heard this before about my crisis. I won't go on for too long about it, but it's a really, really big thing in my life, because I came along as a young man. I got ordained very quickly, just over a year and a half after coming to the centre. I was ordained, and then I really got on with it. I was young, I was idealistic, I was practicing, I was doing all the things that a young order member should do. I was doing all those things, and 20 years later I kind of hit a brick wall. And it was like, let's say, there's the Buddha there and there's me here, and there's the path leading to the Buddha. I realised that I might have got about that far, if that. Just like, blimey, 20 years, I'm only, oh. And I got completely demoralised by the situation I felt myself to be in. That here was I trying to become enlightened, and I was getting almost nowhere. And so I had this massive crisis, and I left the movement. I nearly left the order. I nearly resigned. I left the movement for 2-3 years and went and worked for the Inland Revenue instead, which is not a good option, although they are good employers. But anyway, I just went away and thought, I just can't live the spiritual life. I've tried for 20 years, and it's not working for me. Even though I'm an order member, I was made a member of the Preceptors College, I'd been a chairman for a while, I'd done all those things, but deep inside myself I felt that I hadn't made any progress at all. And the way that, there was many elements to that big crisis, that's just one of them, but the way that particular part of the crisis was solved, by realising that the metaphor of the path leading to a goal doesn't work for me. It just doesn't work, because I don't seem to be able to make any progress on that path. Well, I might make a bit of progress. I go to sleep, next morning I'm back where I started. So the metaphor of the path leading to a goal, I realised, doesn't work for me. And one of the things I read during my crisis time was a novel by John Fowles called The French Lieutenant's Woman. I think it was that one. And towards the end of that novel, somebody says, I can't remember who it was, but somebody says, life is not a road, it's a room. And that really hit me. I thought, oh, that's been my mistake. I thought as life as a kind of road, a journey leading somewhere. But it's not. It's a room. Now, that's a metaphor too, and that the room metaphor has its own problems too, but it really helped me come back into the movement on a completely different basis. So now, I have got no idea whether I've made any spiritual progress or not. I've got no idea. And I don't care. I don't care. I'm just living the Dharma. I'm just dwelling in the Dharma. And if the Dharma works, then presumably I'm making spiritual progress, because I am practicing the Dharma. Rather lazily, I have to admit. I'm a lazy person by nature, but I'm doing my best, given the kind of person I am, to practice the Dharma. And I no longer worry about whether I'm making progress or not. And I'm telling you all this because I'm hoping it might help some of you if you're concerned about the lack of progress that you have made so far. Who knows, you might feel you've made a lot of progress. The other side of this, the making progress on the path metaphor, is the opposite of me, because I tend towards depression, and I have what is called depressive realism. I really know when I haven't made progress, and it's real, it's true, right? But they're another kind of person who tends to inflate themselves. They tend to think they're really, really good. And the path metaphor isn't very good for them either, because they often start thinking, oh, I've made a lot of progress on the path. And that leads to a certain inflation and pride. And in the Asta, the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, where it says here in the Ratnaguna, no state of bodhisattvahood is obtained, the corresponding bit in the Ashta says that if you think I am a bodhisattva, then you are not a bodhisattva. And it talks about the pride of thinking of yourself as a bodhisattva. That's come about from pride. So the whole idea of attainment, obtaining wisdom and obtaining stages on the path, feeds in to one's sense of self and pride and conceit and so on. And in the Ratnaguna Samchayagata actually reminds me very much of some of the very early Pali texts, the very early ones, the fourth and fifth chapters of the Sutta Nipata, for instance. And I might read you a bit of one of those a bit later if we get time. But they're very similar. And although when I've read the Ratnaguna Samchayagata in the past, I haven't understood it. That is to say, I haven't understood it conceptually. But it didn't seem to matter, because every time I read it, I felt peaceful. It gave me a sense of peace and serenity. I was talking to Papavaju about this in a cafe a couple of weeks ago in Sheffield. He said something that he really hit the nail on the head. The Ratnaguna Samchayagata is more about what it doesn't say than what it says. And this is my experience too, that I read it and I think, I don't really understand what it means, but it puts me into a really peaceful state. And peace is one of the main elements of this text, as we heard yesterday. Be at peace. Where am I going to go next with this talk? I think the next bit, let me just remind myself. Yes, so what I want to talk about now is the fact that you don't gain anything in the spiritual life. You don't get something. It's not really like that. And while we're thinking about getting something, it's going to be really frustrating. So, as I said earlier, no highest perfection of wisdom is obtained. But, in verse 12, this is how they, bodhisattvas, practice the highest perfection of wisdom. And in verse 14, this is how they practice the highest perfection of wisdom. So let's bring all this highest perfection of wisdom idea right down to our own experience if we can. Let's take the Metta Bhavana. You teach a beginner the Metta Bhavana, which I've done thousands of times probably. And there's always a problem that they encounter, which is you tell them what metta is, loving kindness, goodwill, friendliness. And then they get an idea what that means, and then in the practice they're trying to get that. They're trying to get metta. They're trying to obtain metta. And of course that doesn't work. And this is another part of my crisis, was in all the 20 years that I've been practicing metta bhavana, I didn't feel that I actually got metta. I never had that warm, glowing feeling inside me that some people talk about when they teach it. Get this warm glow. I thought, no, never had a warm glow when I do the metta bhavana. And that was a big mistake to think in those terms, because the metta bhavana is not about achieving a result in the metta bhavana. It's not about that. The metta bhavana is about changing, and it's about being kind when you're not doing the metta bhavana practice. That's really what it's about. So you don't look for results in the practice. That's a big mistake. A really big mistake. What you look for any results, if you want to look for results, you look for in your life, when you're out there with people. How are you with people? Are you kind to people or not? Are you kinder now? This is, again, one of the big things that I learned in my time out, was although I didn't seem to get much out of doing the metta bhavana, I definitely become kinder as a result of doing it. And I know that from the way people talk to me and what they say about me. It surprises me sometimes at the end of a study retreat or something, and then we get the reporting out, and someone will invariably say, "What one of the things I really appreciated about you, Ratnaguna, was your kindness." And it used to say, "Kindness? I wasn't kind. I'm not kind. I can't do the metta bhavana. I'm not kind." And I was looking for that kind feeling. You know, "How are you today? I'm feeling kind, thank you." You don't say that, do you? It doesn't work like that. Kindness is not a feeling. Kindness is an action. It's something that you do. And I think this is what this text, one of the most important things this text is saying. You don't attain wisdom, you practice it. It's not something you get, it's something you practice. You don't attain metta, you practice metta. It's something that you do. Doesn't matter if you don't feel metta. I've learned this after 40 years of practicing the metta bhavana and probably never once feeling metta. That isn't the point. The point is to act with kindness. Let's take concentration, the mindfulness of breathing. You teach people the mindfulness of breathing and you say, you know, what we're trying to do is become more concentrated, integrated. And they think, oh, okay, that's my goal. I'm going to be concentrated and integrated. And then next week they come back and their mind's all over the place and they feel they've failed. What a pity to think in those terms. Concentration is not something that you get. It's something that you practice. It's something that you're doing. And there are a few metaphors in this text which I find very interesting. They don't use the metaphor of the path. One of the metaphors comes from the word charity. C-A-R-A-T-I, or chari, depending on on the way it's used. And it's the same as the word dharmachari. So I'm a dharmachari. That's what an order member is, a dharmachari. So dharma, chari. Chari can be translated, and Shudapa often in this text translates chari as practice. So dharmachari means, in that sense, dharma practitioner. But it also means, more widely, to live. So another way of understanding dharmachari is someone who lives the dharma. So the word practice, it sounds like something that you do at specific times. I'm practicing meditation, and very often people associate practice with the meditation. How's your practice doing? And people start talking about their meditation, and I might say, yeah, but what about the rest of your practice? How do you live? So in this text, you've got these other metaphors. You've got, in verse 6, for instance, they, bodhisattvas, wander homeless. That's one of the main metaphors of this practice. They wander homeless. Wander homeless is anicca-chari. So in this sense, I think Shudapa must have translated chari as wander. They wander homeless. Now, homelessness is a big part of early Buddhism, isn't it? And in early Buddhism, when the Buddha was teaching, he meant homeless in the literal sense, a physical sense of leaving home and living as a wanderer. But in this text, they change the meaning. They psychologize the meaning, you could say. Wandering homeless doesn't necessarily mean literally that you're a homeless wanderer, but you wander homeless in the Dharma, in the categories of the Dharma, you get this in the Heart Sutra, don't you? Towards the end of the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva holding on to nothing whatsoever. Yeah. Not holding on to anything. Not only physical things, but also the categories of existence that you exist within. So you've got wandering homeless. And actually you get this, in the Magandhya Sutta, this one of the very earliest suttas. Let me just read this to you. Having abandoned home, living free from society, the sage, the wise person, in village creates no intimacies. Reared of sensual passions, free from yearning, he wouldn't engage with people in quarrelsome debate. Now, sometime later, a lay follower has learnt that verse off by heart, and they go and see a monk called Kachayana, and they recite the verse, and the lay follower says, "Can you tell me exactly what that verse means?" And Maha Kachayana doesn't talk about homelessness in the physical sense, because this person's a layman. He's not homeless, so it wouldn't be of any use to tell him about the beauty of homelessness, because he's not going to leave home. He's living at home. So he changes it. He makes it into a metaphor that home is your attachment to the five skandhas, or it's your attachment, your clinging to existence. So there, home becomes attachment and clinging. And he goes on to say that the Tathagata, the Buddha, has no home in that he's not attached to anything. So you get this idea of wandering homeless. And you also get another idea, standing. That comes up a lot in the text. In verse 6, for this kind of bodhisattva, there's not the slightest place in the five skandhas where they can stand firm. Now, what does that mean, to stand firm? Standing firm means to invest yourself in something. So you might stand firm in, let's think of an example, your idea of who you are, the kind of person you are. You stand firm in that, your self-view, let's say. Oh, I'm this kind of person. And you stand on that. That's who you are. And that gives you your sense of security. That's who you are. So you get a sense of security from that. And what the Buddha's saying is wander. Wander homeless rather than standing firm in something. Although, in verse 10, he says of the bodhisattvas, they attain the firmness of wisdom. The firmness of wisdom. So you've got standing firm, and you've got wandering homeless, and then you've got dwelling in. So in verse 7, the Buddha says, a bodhisattva who understands does not take hold of nirvana, does not grab it, does not grasp it for himself, but dwells in wisdom, dwelling in wisdom rather than taking hold of. Because if you have the metaphor of taking hold of wisdom, you're bigger than wisdom. You take wisdom. Wisdom is now yours. But when you dwell in wisdom, wisdom is bigger than you, and you dwell in that wisdom. And there's another lovely sutta, the Mahanama Sutta, where Mahanama, another layman, the Buddha's been staying for 3 months of the rainy season near to where he lives, and the Buddha's more recently been quite ill. But then the Buddha gets better, but it's time to go. It's time to go wandering again, wandering. And so Mahanama goes to see the Buddha, and he says, you're just about to go wandering. You're no longer going to dwell in this place that you've been dwelling in for the last 3 months. So you're going to go wandering. Can you tell me where I should dwell? What dwelling place I should have? Because he's a layman, remember. So the Buddha says, yeah, that's a very good question. You should dwell in the five spiritual faculties. That's where you should dwell. In other words, you should dwell in practice. You should live in your practice. So I think what this text is getting at is that we need to be careful of the metaphors we use. And the metaphors that we use, the words that we can use, as Dave said yes to me over lunch, one of the things we have to be careful of is not to get trapped by our own language, trapped by words. And it's quite easy to get trapped by words. And one of the things that the Perfection of Wisdom texts are doing is trying to use words to get out of the traps that we put ourselves into in words. So you've got the metaphors of wandering homeless, and in a way wandering homeless is similar to what I talked about at the beginning of the talk, the state of positive bewilderment, where, or in the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva holding on to nothing whatsoever, having a home nowhere. Now this is a very, very high ideal, and it's probably something that most of us are not ready to completely wander homeless. We have to hold on to something. And I want to end this talk by just talking about the positive element of the metaphor, the home. We have to have a home. We live somewhere. We dwell somewhere. None of us are homeless. And probably we also need a home in our mind, somewhere we can feel safe and where we can dwell. And hopefully that home is the Dhamma. Eventually we'll need to leave that home. It's like the raft. The raft, to use another metaphor, the raft takes you across the other shore, but when you're there you have to leave that raft. So eventually we have to leave home. But what we have to do in the meantime is build a home which helps us to grow and develop. So that's the home. Probably many of the homes that we live in at the moment don't really do that. They keep us trapped. But what we need to do is build a home which can become enlarger and larger and larger. And I want to end up with the Vimalakirti Nidesha, which is another Perfection of Wisdom text. And what happens at the beginning of that is the Buddha, the first chapter is about the Buddha, homeless. He's staying outside of the city of Vaishali in Amrapali's park. He's just staying there for a while before he wanders on somewhere else. So there he is with his disciples. That's the first chapter. The second chapter begins with Vimalakirti, the layman, at home. And that second chapter begins at that time. So it means it's happening at the same time that the Buddha's outside the city in Amrapali, homeless. Vimalakirti, the great Bodhisattva, is in Vaishali, in his home. These are happening at the same time. If you had a film, you'd have to have a split screen. And what happens is Vimalakirti, over the course of the whole text, people come to see him in his home. Yeah? And after a while, you realize that his house must be absolutely massive, because at the end of every chapter, thousands, tens of thousands of beings come to see him, his home. And his home, of course, is empty, it's shunyata, so it can take as many people as you like. So while the Buddha's wandering homeless, Vimalakirti is staying at home. But what is his home? His home is his practice of the Dharma. He hasn't settled down in any particular spot. It's his practice of the Dharma. And it's his Bodhisattva life. It's his teaching of the Dharma too. So his home gets bigger and bigger and bigger, until in the end, there are so many people in his house that it makes no sense anymore to call it a house. What is a house with 2 million people in it? Is that a house? Can't be a house, surely. It's just bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually what he does in the final chapter, he takes his house with all these beings in it, millions of beings in it, he takes it right out to Amrapali's park so that they can be with the Buddha in the homeless realm. He takes his home of the Dharma and his Bodhisattva practice out into the homeless realm, and he bows down to the Buddha, who is completely homeless. And I think I'll leave it there.